Very welcome everyone to this seminar. Business and human rights in development cooperation. Is Sweden on the right track? It is arranged by the EBA, the expert group for aid studies, and we are really, really pleased to see that it's actually full today. Although it doesn't look completely full right now, on paper it is. So perhaps we have a few additional latecomers. As we all know, evaluators of development cooperation like life studies. So before introducing myself, I would just like to make a little baseline study. So if we take the question of today, is Sweden on the right track? I thought it might be interesting to just ask you briefly in the audience if you have an opinion already now when coming here. So everyone who thinks that yes, absolutely we are, please raise your hand. Okay, not completely overwhelming. So those of you who think that, yes, perhaps, perhaps not. Slightly more. And those who feel that, no, we're absolutely not going in the right direction. Okay. So the middle option was slightly in favor when we start today. So we will see where we stand when we end. My name is Anna Nilsdotter. I am a member of the expert group for aid studies. And I've had the pleasure of chairing this study, which we will discuss here today. I also have a background where I worked extensively with human rights and business, for example, for Amnesty International, but also as a sustainability consultant working with Swedish multinationals. So for me personally, this is the most interesting report we've ever done, actually, in the expert group. I thought it was very interesting, and I hope you will find it so as well. A few words about EBA. I think many of you who are here today know us already. For those of you who don't, the expert group for aid studies is a government committee responsible for evaluating and analyzing Sweden's international development cooperation. We produce studies and we organize seminars on issues and themes of importance to the Swedish development cooperation sector. How many of you have been to one of our seminars before? Not that many, actually. We have many. You're very welcome in the future, too. And when we describe our role, we like to use the word dual independence to summarize it. And that means that we independently decide what studies to be commissioned, but the studies are generally written by external authors who are also independently responsible for the content of the reports. We don't give our own opinion about each and every report, but once a year we summarize our analysis and report to the government. So today we have the pleasure of launching this new EBA report, which is also the first report seminar this year. Business and Human Rights in Development Cooperation. Has Sweden incorporated the UN Guiding Principles? Written by Rasmus Klöcke Larsen and Sandra Attler. And just a brief background before I give the floor to the authors. The past years, we have seen different trends in development cooperation, with more focus on business and private sector activities than before. And in line with this, the Swedish government has encouraged state actors in development cooperation to actively seek partnerships with the private sector. Although this approach obviously opens new opportunities, without doubt it also brings potential challenges and risks. And another trend we have seen the past years is the increased focus on corporate responsibility for human rights. Obviously the two together is interesting. This study offers a unique analysis of how well the Swedish state actors in development has adapted to the UN guiding principles of business and human rights, which now have been up and running for roughly 5 years. And of course, this is also interesting relating to the ambition of policy coherence and the government policy on global development, PGU. So, a few practical questions before I introduce the authors. First of all, we will open up for questions in the panel discussion, so please save your questions for later. This is a small informal setting, so we really encourage questions and contributions from the audience, especially considering that so many of you who actually work actively with the questions are here today. And I just wanted to mention also that when we planned the seminar, we were hoping that the government would be present in the panel to represent their views. Unfortunately, the representatives suitable to be in the panel weren't able to make it. So we hope that they will read the report and benefit from it later. And we also hope that you who really work practically with the questions will add your contributions and questions from the floor. Finally, you see the hashtag #EBBAseminar. So feel free to tweet. And when you start doing that, you will discover all interesting previous seminars we have had with some contributions. We haven't used it in every seminar, but in quite a few. So, finally, we have Jessica. Can you just raise your hand, Jessica? She will take some pictures today to use in our external communications. If anyone of you feels uncomfortable being in a picture, please just talk to Jessica. She'll make sure that she takes you away from it. So, let me briefly introduce the authors of the study. Rasmus Klöcke Larsen is a research fellow at the Stockholm Environment Institute, SEI, and previously also held a position as researcher at the Center for Sustainable Development at Uppsala University. Larsen holds a PhD from Wageningen University, and his research and development praxis ranges from community-based impact assessment through process design and leadership and stakeholder dialogues to review of the coherence and implementability of policies. Sandra Attler is a human rights lawyer and the director of ENACT Human Rights and Business Practice Group, ENACT, which is a sustainability consultancy, and she is a previously independent consultant. She is an expert on business and human rights and has many years of experience working directly with companies to implement and address human rights. She has worked extensively in Africa with the mining and extractive sector, and she has previously assisted Professor John Ruggie, the former UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Business and Human Rights, which is a long title, and his team with research and advice when developing the UN Guiding Principles for Business and Human Rights. So, please, Sandra and Rasmus, I'll give the floor to you.
Thank you, Anna. Do you hear me all right?
Yeah.
It's a great pleasure to be here. After 1.5 years, we were debating when we started this study, and it's quite shocking how long a report like this takes to produce. So we hope you'll read it. I think Anna, you already sort of took away the core pitch of our opening slide, and I think that shows the coordination between EBA and us. But I'll just reiterate sort of the background to the study and the storyline that we'll try and give you today. So what we're exploring is really this tension between different interests in development aid when you engage companies, which is a growing trend today, for better and worse, opening many opportunities, but also creating new risks related to human rights impacts. The question that we have explored, you see here in the middle of the slide, which is really how far has Sweden come, or to what extent is Swedish aid institutions aligned with the United Nations Guiding Principles? And we believe that this is, in fact, the first study of Swedish aid from the perspective of the United Nations Principles, the GPs, but also internationally the first time a specific study has been done with this perspective on development aid. So we hope that it will have resonance also in that regard. Sort of the main takeaway you see in the bottom, perhaps, is that we have observed extensive and impressive work in many agencies by many civil servants and employees, but that despite this substantial work, none of the institutions, the five that we have looked at, are actually fully aligned with the guiding principles, which is also offering opportunities for improvement and work ahead. And then just to say that we give you the very condensed version here. 20 minutes is what we have, and we hope to go into more detail in the panel, but there will invariably be a lot of details that we cannot discuss with you, so we look forward to also follow-up conversations.
And just so a word on the benchmark that we have used for this study, something called the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, which some of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with, whereas others may not have heard it. These are essentially principles for business on human rights. So the problem with all the other conventions and declarations out there is that they are written by states for states. So this is the first time in world history that the United Nations has actually, in an intergovernmental authoritative document, pronounced what is expected of companies, because companies are not bound by public international law. So this is a kind of binding, you could spend a lot of time arguing on for or against, but essentially 2011, it's been there for now soon 5 years. The important thing here is that it says two things. There's a duty for the state to do certain things, which means to protect human rights. And in this context, the important thing is against corporate-related harm on human rights. And the business responsibility, which is independent from the government and the states, is to do no harm. I just want to point out that this is not about charity or philanthropy. It's about doing no harm. All the other stuff, building schools and hospitals, is great, but that is not what we're talking about. We're talking about all the bad things that happen in corporate value chains and by corporations. We have made an interpretation of this, because these are quite high-level principles. We have made an interpretation, researching all that there is out there about what could possibly, how could you take this responsibility, and now we're looking at the responsibility of the state and the state authorities in the context of international development. So we've taken that and we've analyzed what are our interpretations on what this means for the government and the state agencies and state-owned companies. So in short, and you'll see more on this, I won't go in in-depth, but in essence, we've interpreted to be make a commitment by the ministries, create awareness, make sure that there is observance, make sure that there is human rights due diligence, make sure that there is control and transparency. State agencies, state-owned and controlled companies are the ones that need to put this into practice with all the due process that comes with it.
And before going any further and making sure that we present so the key findings, we will give you the top three positives and negatives. And maybe we should have called the negatives opportunities for improvement, but we didn't reach that level of editing in our presentation here. So the top three positives, as you're aware, firstly, Sweden is the eighth country that has actually launched a national action plan, which shows commitment and sets out a path forward. In the institutions we have studied, there are, in almost all of them, a commitment in the steering documents to the guiding principles, which is also showing that there has been action taken after the endorsement by the United Nations. And then thirdly, we very clearly sensed in our interviews with civil servants and staff and companies a commitment and interest and awareness regarding this work, and we probably believe that this is the most promising factor in the study.
So yes, these are the, in short, opportunities for change. So we've seen that the big gap, perhaps one of the big gaps, is that ministries, the government, do not encourage or require human rights due diligence of agencies or state-owned or controlled companies. And why is this important? Well, in situations where there's a high risk to human rights, what human rights due diligence means is that there is would then be a mandatory requirement by companies and the authorities to ensure that whatever the risks are, they are being addressed. So human rights due diligence is making sure that you know your risks, not relying on your gut feeling, because just being Swedish won't take you all that far all the way. And also making sure that there are systems and procedure in place for addressing them. The second point, which we didn't think we would run into so much problems with as we actually have, is the issue on transparency and access to information. It's been shown in various contexts that we've had, both with authorities and the companies and the ministries, that it's quite hard to get the information that we wanted. We have requested essentially three types of documents: policies, procedures, and reports of implementation. The policies have been easy to access, but the procedures and the implementation have been very difficult, and it's been very different between the different organizations what level that they've been willing to provide us with information. And thirdly, there is really no tracking of performance yet. This is a very new, these are new principles, yes, but of course we need to make sure that there are means to ensure that we're on the right track. If we set out high level commitments, we also want to make sure that we're on the right track, and there are really no controls to that point.
So just a brief method on the method or the approach that we adopted in the study. We have used what we call a qualitative case study methodology, and which basically means that we focused on a subset of activities funded by Swedish aid. And in this case, we decided to focus on mining in Africa or Swedish aid activities linked to African mining. We quite quickly discovered, as we also discussed with some of you in here already, that there isn't very much aid from Sweden going to the African mining sector or linked to the mining sector. But we still identified a number of activities, projects and programs that provided tangible activities and documents that we could focus on and discuss in interviews with colleagues in institutions. The data generation took place via these three activities: number of interviews, systematic analysis of documents, and a mapping of development activities. And then we also should flag a limitation of the study and a qualification, which we also have discussed with some of you that participated in the study. The guiding principles were adopted in 2011, and several of the activities we looked at were kicked off prior to that date. So we have, of course, looked at activities that have been implemented with decisions based on risk assessment that were enacted prior to a new round of updates of policies and procedures within the institutions that we have studied. At the same time, we have looked at procedure and policy, so we have had a level of generality in the assessment here. So many of the findings, most of the findings, are relevant nonetheless, but it doesn't show you sort of the what step forward has been taken with the guiding principles necessarily on implementation, on concrete implementation. Thanks, Sandra. And then just a quote just to show the kind of sort of the evidence that we have used. This is a quote from one of the interviews. I don't know if you can read it in the back, but it alludes to this conflict of interest between development of human rights objectives and business objectives. And we think it's interesting that there is that awareness among colleagues in the institutions. I think I'm continuing, is that right, Sandra? Yeah. So just giving you the overview of our sort of sample size, if there are any biologists or natural scientists in here, 5 state institutions that were selected based on an objective to obtain a certain diversity in terms of mandate, in terms of supervising institution, and their type, simply. So you see the diversity there. And an explanation of the terminology. When we say actor institution, we refer to all institutions, and otherwise there's a very important distinction between the ministries that are what we refer to as a state, and then the agencies or authorities that are implementing arms of the state, and then the state-owned companies, which have different responsibilities, as Sandra referred to.
Okay, so for those of you who don't have the energy to read 108 pages, here's the short summary. to just summarize, maybe say one thing about one strength and one challenge for each of the institutions that we investigated. We also organize them by a relative ranking, and there are various challenges with obviously comparing state-owned or controlled companies with state authorities, but nevertheless, we realize that what we actually do is we're looking for the consideration of human rights and internal procedure, and it makes for a really interesting case to do the comparison. Swedfund is the only organization where we found a mandatory human rights due diligence requirement, and this is something that we consider to be good practice. Challenge include to make sure that there is full coverage of all universally recognized human rights in the procedure. And this reflects, just to make a brief comment on that, industry practice, which often refers to IFC standards, and the fact that IFC standards do not cover the full range of universally recognized human rights. This is our opinion. SEK, the strengths include internal procedures, where there's been a lot of effort and works on integrating human rights and business into internal procedures. And this is really one of the important elements for us to make sure that you move from gut feeling to systematics and structure. One of the challenges with various, we should actually say all of the actors that we worked with, has been transparency. So it's not just SEK, but one of their challenges also included transparency and access to information. CEDA, same thing there, internal procedure. Lots of really good work and internal procedure around incorporating the due diligence procedures and so forth. Although the challenge which we were confronted with was perhaps inconsistent approaches. Depending on where in the organization you look, there are different approaches to what involving a business actor actually means and what is covered. Business Sweden and SGU perhaps are the ones that have become involved in the field of development cooperation only by the last years. So it is also to be expected that they are maybe slightly behind on the journey or just starting their journey. Business Sweden has a commitment to it, which is commendable and a strength. However, there are no internal procedures. SGU, there we came across a very strong willingness of the staff to start this journey. Nevertheless, there were no internal procedures as well. And then just to reflect through quotes again, some of the quotes that we came across during the interviews. It's not easy to map risks in another country. We had to trust our gut feeling and recommendation from others. And obviously this is what we're trying to move away from, gut feelings versus systems. And transparency. In the shareholder agreement with the company, there are secrecy clauses that state that we cannot disclose information without the consent of other shareholders. So obviously these are some of the challenges that are real for the institutions and companies working on these issues when stakeholders and the public, like us, are requesting information to be able to make determinations of whether human rights are actually considered.
Thanks, Sandra. And then just looking at the time, I'm wondering, maybe we have organized our analysis according to 8 questions, which are reflecting our interpretation of the guiding principles. So as you see here on the first slide, you see question 1 and 2. Each of these questions reflects an interpretation of the guiding principles that we ask that question to each institution. In the interest of time, I think we just have to simply just show them and then go straight to the conclusions, and then we hopefully... We'll get back to that, and the slideshow here will be on the website after the seminar. Probably just have to go straight here. So the conclusions, this is referring to the overall sort of insights that we draw from the study across the institutions and ministries that we looked at, is that status is that ministries have set out a high level of expectation for most institutions. SGU does not have such a commitment, but the rest do. But that could be more done in terms of support, training, guidance on what does that mean that a certain institution should follow the guiding principles, when is something mandatory, how should things be done, and so on. Secondly, looking at CEDA as the main development actor in Sweden, we found very substantial procedures and commendable work, but also identified areas where there's improvement, opportunities for improvement relating to human rights due diligence, for instance, and transparency, as Sandra mentioned. The new actors, SGU, Business Sweden, or newer actors, were the ones that performed poorest, and perhaps that's not surprising, given the fact that they just enter this journey. And there's opportunity to learn from or between institutions as well. Then I think we were surprised to see that in some instances, state-owned companies, SEK and Swedfund, actually performed better according to the analysis that we conducted than the agencies. And normally you would assume that an agency, which is a direct arm of the state, is in the forefront of implementing the guiding principles. And we think it's partly linked to perhaps the second bullet point, which is describing the impression that the many civil servants in Sweden seem to perceive the guiding principles as mainly being an opportunity for companies, i.e. the second pillar, to take new actions. And I think our study, perhaps hopefully, could also be a suggestion to reconsider what the state has to do. That it's very easy to expect companies to take action, but there are a number of actions that the state has to take in order to provide an enabling environment for companies. And then finally, we have revisited the National Action Plan that was launched last year with a view from our findings. And we have seen a number of cases where the action plan reflects the exact recommendations that we've come up with, which is, of course, great from our perspective and gives confidence and also in our findings. But we also identified a number of areas where the action plan does not say anything. And we have listed these in the report and would encourage further work in these areas. Maybe that's good, and I'll hand to Sandra.
And then also, so for the recommendations, if we were to boil it down, in summary, for the Swedish state to answer the question that with confidence, yes, we are preventing and addressing all human rights harm in connection to Swedish Development Corporation and money used by Swedish taxpayers, we think that there is quite a lot more that needs to be done. Because right now we believe that given the current system and what is in place, we cannot with confidence answer yes to that question. We believe that, in part, what needs to happen is that the ministries need to require human rights due diligence, at least in situations that pose high risk to human rights. There needs to be a clearer guidance to states, companies, as well as authorities to provide support, training, and information to make sure that there is a consistent approach to business and human rights. Right now, it varies very much depending on who is at what position in the agencies and companies. And increase knowledge that, in fact, that these principles apply to the state, not just to business. Put controls in place to ensure that there is follow-up to make sure that we're actually managing these issues. And to agencies and state-owned or controlled companies, our main recommendations on a generic level is to, again, strengthen the exercise of human rights due diligence, again, mandatory in human rights in high-risk situations, to make sure that there are policies, systems, and procedures rather than gut feelings in place for all human rights, internationally recognized human rights risk, even though we recognize that industry practice, largely on a global level, sometimes don't cover all. And, of course, improve transparency and disclosure information to stakeholders and the public.
I think that's it. Maybe we are sort of before time. It never happened in an EBA seminar. But thank you for your attention, and we look forward to go into the details with Elin and Theo and the rest of you during the seminar. Thank you.
So, thank you so much, Sandra and Rasmus, for a very interesting presentation. And I'm sure there is a lot of questions out here, and just record them for later. You will soon be given the floor.